Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl, and I'm an experienced bartender.
And I'm Tommy Smurl. I'm an experienced drinker.
He's my dad, and together this is...
Neat! A weekly booze cast.
With history lessons, trivia, and a twist.
So pull up a stool to the bar and join us for the lowdown on your highball.
All right, well, hello again. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Dad?
Thank you. Glad to be here. I wouldn't abandon you after one show. I'm here for the long haul.
You'd probably be pretty sad. You're my dad. That would be an extra, that'd be extra mean.
Nobody voted me off the island this week, so
not yet.
I'm still here. I'm surviving. How about you? How'd your week go?
It was another week. You know, they all just kind of... Our one, the maxi week is what we're in.
Just runs together, huh?
Yeah, but I did. It's hard to get into the Halloween spirit right now. But I do make attempts. You know, with watching lots of spooky films. I made a pumpkin soup, so that seems like a spooky thing to do. I don't know. How's your week been?
Well, it's been pretty good. The girls made some Halloween cookies when they were over visiting their Mimi,
the
grand girls. They were just sugar cookies, and they got to decorate them with different things. Charlie did a very good job decorating hers. Cooper's looks a little bit more like a Jackson Pollock.
That's fine. It's high art. She's going for it. I like that.
But
she was trying to capture the violence of, you know, the slasher genre on her cookie, I think.
Actually, I think it's just that she likes the maximum density of sprinkles and icing and everything else that you can put on top of a cookie. The more, the merrier.
That is function. All right. I appreciate that, too.
You just take a bite and all, it just crumbles right off the top everywhere.
That's the right way to do it. Well, you know, one thing that I like to partake of the macabre year round, but I think now more than ever is perhaps a great time to appreciate one of our great spooky American authors, Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh yeah, Edgar Allan Poe. He's got a spooky name.
He's got a very spooky name. It maybe wasn't spooky before he was Edgar Allan Poe, but now it is spooky. He made all those words spooky.
He made that name spooky.
He did. Now, you know, you name a kid Edgar and it's like, oh, so you're goth and you want your kid to be a goth.
That's right. Yeah, you don't get too many Edgars these days.
No, it's too bad. I think it's a good name. I like Edgar.
It'll come back around. Names come back around.
Maybe.
That's like you don't have many Tommies these days either.
A couple Toms in my class, but then
I don't know
what the youth is doing.
That's what I mean. The young ones that currently now, not ones in their 30s or 40s, but the ones coming out now, you know.
Well, yeah, those Edgars and Toms, they'll be back again.
That's right. Edgar Allan Poe's and Tom Thumbs.
All right. So the reason I wanted to bring Poe to the table today is because...
he's got a spooky name.
He's got a spooky name. He's a spooky guy. But one of his spooky stories specifically references alcohol. So I thought it'd be kind of a good thing to get into. And I do want to say, Dad, we previously have done a couple episodes on this show where we kind of dubbed them famous drinker episodes.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about the life and exploits and drink preferences of somebody who famously enjoyed imbibing.
I've never been featured, have I?
Not yet, but you know, this is what this is. This is just a long feature on famous drinker Tommy Smurl.
See how long I can hang in there.
There you go. No, But I kind of had in my mind like Poe on a list of eventual topics to cover. But once I started actually getting into some research of him, I felt like it was a little bit wrong to include him in that kind of framing, because really Poe's relationship with alcohol seems to be something that was both
a struggle for him all his life.
Well, it is. It was a struggle. It was something that he adamantly tried to maintain sobriety. He had a lot of other family members in his life that were alcoholics that clearly caused him a lot of pain. And I think like the association with him and drinking, it's largely been kind of blown up by the fanfare, the romanticism around him, and also was something that was kind of weaponized against him by a lot of his rivals.
Yeah, I never, when I was reading about him, I never knew of somebody that had, they kept mentioning his enemies and this other guy that's his enemy. And I'm like, who goes through life and they're accumulating enemies? How does this happen? And evidently, the literary world was a very dog-eat-dog world. So if you wrote something good and it was, you know, better than somebody else wrote, then the guy's like, oh, that bastard, I hate him. He's my enemy now. I'm going to have to get him. I'm going to talk bad about him. I'm going to write something, and everybody's going to know it's about him, and it's going to be something bad. I'm going to talk about him being an alcoholic because I heard he was drunk once.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really cruel. Like, I thought that was kind of an exaggeration at first, too, but it's pretty evident. Like, there were other writers that had characters that were, you know, proxies for Poe in their stories that were, you know, meant to insult him. Even after his death, there was another writer that wrote under a fake name, sort of a eulogy for him that was really just, it was about how troubled and dark and drunk he was. And I mean, the man himself, from his accounts of friends and family and his own recordings, he couldn't hold his alcohol very well. So there was that. Like, he would have a few drinks and just be a mess. And when he started, he wasn't great at stopping, but he had long periods of his life of total sobriety.
Yeah. Well, he might have been allergic to alcohol or whatever, because, you know, it hit him. That's what they said. He would only have one drink and they would find him under the table or something like that. And so it wasn't that he drank vast quantities. He evidently, he just had some type of an intolerance for it.
Well, there's like, I mean, you know, I think that's that sort of that romanticizing of somebody's alcoholism. If it's somebody we've talked about previously on the show, like Hemingway and like Humphrey Bogart, and they talked about drinking, they wrote about drinking, they liked drinking up until the day that they were no longer with us. I think it's, you know, it's kind of part of their myth. But when it's sort of forced on a figure that didn't necessarily, clearly struggled with it, and it was a detriment to their life, I'm not gonna, you know, like, reduce them to that.
Yeah, I mean, because really one of the things that I think of first when it comes to Edgar Allan Poe is absinthe. I always heard that he was one of the ones that more or less made that a common drink in America, and it's really not true.
No, that traces back fairly recently. There's a book on absinthe that talks about Poe drinking with Baudelaire, I believe, the two never met, but also, I mean, that was not like, absinthe was not culturally what it was in Europe. It was not in America. So Poe might have crossed paths with absinthe, but he was not famously known by his friends for drinking absinthe. You know, he drank what a lot of Americans during that time of in American culture drank. You know, he probably drank things like sherry and port and bourbon and brandy, but clearly not in high amounts. And that's what I think that Poe's attitude, just as much as we can see a lot of these other famous drinkers' attitudes towards alcohol in their writing, I think we can kind of get a glimpse of Poe's attitude towards drinking from one of the first stories I remember reading by Poe, and one of my favorites, which is A Cast of Amontillado.
Mm-hmm. I remember that one.
Yeah. So that was first published in November of 1846. The Cask of Amontillado. Amontillado is a form of sherry. That's why it's topical.
I've always heard of sherry, but I've never had sherry.
You've never had sherry? Never.
Never. I've had brandy. I don't know if it's like brandy, but I've never had sherry.
Well,
there was a song back in the 60s or something like that, Sherry.
It was about Sherry, or was it like that Sherry Baby song?
Yeah, that's it. Sherry, okay, whoa. Sherry.
Gonna come up?
Sherry, baby.
That's about a lady named Sherry. I think that was just, that was a lady.
Yeah, probably
that
so.
Wasn't about the drink.
Well, you know, it could be like Neil Diamond did. He sang the song Cracklin' Rosie, and that was really about wine. The whole song is he's singing about his wine. And everybody thought it was a love song to a woman, but Cracklin' Rosie is about Cracklin' Rosé.
Well, you know, I have not done a deep dive into if Sherry Baby is, in fact, about the Spanish fortified wine. So I'd be curious, I guess.
You never know.
Yeah, so Casa Amontillado, in this story, it tells the tale of one man luring another to the depths of his family crypt with the promise of a delicious taste of Amontillado sherry, only to then wall this man up and bury him alive. So there's the victim, Fortunato, who ignores several pretty blatant omens of death. It's a short story with a lot of like imagery of like, yo, you're gonna die, you're definitely gonna die, see that thing on the wall, that means you're gonna die. Like, there's a lot that he could turn away, but he doesn't. And ultimately the man who's leading there is also the narrator, Montresor, walls him up in the walls of his family crypt to, you know, starve and die. So it's a horrible death that he's led to in service to his addiction and his obsession with alcohol.
And as in Poe's life, it's an enemy that he's doing for untold insults that he has bestowed upon him.
Yeah, I really want to know what this man did to him, because you're right, he never says. He just says like his various and innumerable insults to me. You don't get to know what those are.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't list what he actually did, but whatever it did, you'd think must have been pretty bad if you're going to wall the guy up for it.
Yeah, but it's really it's fascinating how many times, you know, the narrator gives Fortunato the chance to escape his fate. Like, he all but tells him, no, don't come with me. You mm-hmm. have a cough, don't come. There's someone else who can taste this and give me their opinion. Don't come. Like, he gives him so many outs, but this just, you know, this man is just destined for this horrible fate.
But he also plays to his ego that, you know, so-and-so could taste it, but he doesn't do as good a job. Your palate is the one that can make the determination.
I do. It is interesting. When I was doing some research, there is an article that's written by, it's like a sommelier, a wine specialist, who's talking about the questionable strength of Fortunato's wine knowledge, because evidenced by the fact that he says, oh, no, that guy won't know good Amontillado. He doesn't know Amontillado from sherry, which he repeats several times. And it's a weird statement, because Amontillado is sherry. So it's a bit of a lack of knowledge either on Poe's part or Fortunato's part that's intended. Hard to say. The other part, of course, is that Fortunato drinks this very expensive wine that he's given as they go downwards into the crypt. The narrator serves him some wine, and he just drinks this really expensive wine in a single gulp. Mm-hmm. So is he really this fine appreciator of wine, or is he just an alcoholic?
He's just looking for a free drink.
Yeah. But when I first read this story, I think I was in high school. I was definitely going through my mall goth Edgar Allan Poe phase. I will say, you know, there's a lot of alcohol that I thought would taste one way when I was young, and then when I tried it, I'm like, oh, that's not good. That's not what I thought that would taste like. You know, you think like wine's gonna taste like just sweet, delicious grape juice. You think like beer is gonna taste like, I don't know, I thought like caramel and ginger, you know, that it was just gonna be this delicious cream soda. But I will say that my thoughts as like a young person of what sherry, what this Amontillado must taste like that is worth dying for, what I thought it would taste like, I think is one of the few situations where the liquor lived up to my expectations when I actually did try sherry.
Well, good for sherry. It didn't let you down. All those other disappointing alcohols, and this one lived up to the hype.
They were disappointing. When I first started drinking, I had a very uneducated and very sweet-leaning palate. And when I was in college, my sophomore year, one of my roommates who was definitely underage, but still managed to land a job at a very trendy, high-end sherry bar. This little teeny, like, exclusive club in Soho. And
I've never heard of a sherry bar.
It was a sherry bar. It was called N-A, so just N with an accent symbol. That's how cool it was. Mm. The name was not a word. It was just a letter.
Wow, that's pretty good when you get by with just a letter.
Yeah, but it was a sherry bar. And so on slow nights, she would let us come in and sit at the bar and drink sherry out of little glasses. And I'm sure she gave us, now my recollection, I'd say, I bet she gave us dessert sherry, because I don't think I would have appreciated fine sherry at the time. But it was definitely very sweet and thick and syrupy, and I loved it. I thought it was the best thing in the world.
I can just see some guy come in and plop down. I'll have a beer. This is a sherry bar. Okay, fine, I'll have a beer. We don't have beer, we have sherry. I don't want sherry, I want a beer.
I think if you managed to get in that door, you knew what you were coming for. They might have had other stuff there. It wasn't something where we got to order anything. She would give us what she could give us. But yeah, so that definitely started a young fixation on sherry. And I do wonder, it's not something a lot of people know about. I think it's associated as kind of an old person's drink. So I'm surprised you haven't tried it yet, Dad.
No, well, yeah, being an old person, right? You just start drinking it, huh? But see, I'm not a wine drinker. You know that. I don't drink wine. I've tried to. I want to like wine, but I just don't. I don't know why. I never could. But I'm more of a beer drinker, and I'll drink some bourbon and stuff from time to time. A margarita, pina colada.
Well,
I guess I drink everything but sherry, come to think of it.
Give it a chance. I think it's different. It's not. It is wine, but it is not wine. Actually, you know what? I should explain what it is. That would be helpful.
Well, go ahead. Educate me.
Yeah. So what is sherry? Sherry, like I mentioned, it's a fortified wine. So that's a wine that's had its proof driven up. It's made exclusively in a specific region of Spain, known as the Marco de Jerez, or the Sherry Triangle. I think maybe a better triangle to be stuck in than like the Bermuda Triangle.
Well, we know why you get lost if you're in the Sherry Triangle.
I could be just as dangerous. You're right. I don't think I would make my way. I think if I found my way into the Sherry Triangle, I would not escape by choice. The reason it's a triangle is because the area is defined by three towns there. There's Jerez, Sanlúcar de Barrameda, and El Puerto de Santa Maria. So these three towns are where sherry can legally be aged. And this is the only area that it can legally be made. Now you'll see like California sherry, or, you know, like I think that there's other places in the world will label their thing as sherry, but they have to specify where it comes from. And it's really not, it's not sherry. Sherry has to come from this area. It can be, it can really range in style. It can be bone dry. It can be dessert level sweet. There's a wide range of expressions. And a lot of the character of sherry is said to come from the land itself. So there's a really unique chalk and clay content of the soils of this area, and also this really predictable climate. So they very much know the influences that are going to happen to the sherry as it ages. Also, that's like coastal, and a lot of people say that the sea air influences the flavor of the sherry. Mm-hmm. So very specific, kind of like what we were talking about with bourbon, and then the week before that with like French appellations. This is a controlled, regulated product.
Do they age it in barrels as well?
They do. So the sherry making process, which involves aging, and the aging is actually a huge part of the character of sherry. But you start with a base wine, just like any other wine. You know, grapes are harvested, they're crushed, the juice ferments. For drier sherries, they use Palomino grapes, and they let the sugar convert almost completely to alcohol, whereas for sweeter sherries, the two grapes allowed are Muscatel and Pedro Ximenez grapes. And those, the fermentation period is a little shorter so that it retains some of that residual sugar from the actual pressing.
Mm-hmm.
So after you have your base wine, you fortify it with a grape-derived neutral spirit. How much you fortify it, how much you drive up the alcohol content of it with that grape neutral spirit, it really determines how it's going to be aged. But after you've added it, you place it in old American oak barrels, usually at least 10 years old. Like, by that I mean they don't want new oak. They want oak that has had wine in it, sucking out all of those tannins, all of those woodsy flavors for at least 10 years. And okay. Then they'll use it for their sherry.
But it's ones that formerly had wine.
It's usually wine, yes. I mean, it's just, they want old, they basically just want barrels that have had all the flavor sucked out of them. And yes, usually then the wine has been used to store it, so you get more of like a, you know, you're going to always get flavors of whatever was used to store it beforehand. And wine will be a more compatible, neutral flavor than anything else, like an American whiskey barrel or something.
But they don't use bourbon barrels, though?
No.
Okay.
Not that I'm aware of, but those... After they're filled with their sherry, those barrels are going to be aged inside bodegas, which is a Spanish wine storehouse. So here in New York City, and like many cities, bodegas means the corner store. Mm-hmm. But bodega actually originates from like a meaning of apothecary or wine cellar.
So that's like their rickhouses.
Yeah. It's funny. Now I understand there was a wine bar in a neighborhood I used to live in. That it had actually just been a Spanish bodega, just like a convenience store on the corner that closed down. They reopened a wine bar there, and they called the wine bar Bodega. And so worked on several levels. when you get into the aging process, this is really where you get the differential expressions of sherry. Sherry legally has to be aged using a Solera system. Now, what that means is that instead of each year producing a unique but, you know, inconsistent product... Like, you know, this is my wine. I grew it in 2017. I put it in a barrel in 2017. I took it out in 2020. That's a 2017 wine, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to taste different than a 2018 or a 2016.
Yeah.
What the Solera system says is that you take your oldest sherry and you're going to cut it in with your newest sherry and you're going to blend it so you get a consistent product year after year.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't have good years and bad years. It's all the same thing, huh?
Exactly. And this isn't, you know, I think sometimes the term blend gets a bad connotation in the liquor world. We think it's lower quality, but it's really a case-by-case basis as far as if it's done just to make the most of whatever you've got left over. Or in this case, it is far more expensive and really, like, you have to have a master blender in the house to ensure that sherry tastes the same from generation to generation. So it's actually a very complicated process.
Well, yeah, and it's probably a way that they need to make more money too, because the longer you let it sit there, you have to wait that much longer to sell it and get your money. So that way you can use the younger stuff faster and by mixing it with the older stuff, and you can make your older stuff last longer to be able to mix it.
Well, I mean, it's also, though, for in the case of sherry, it's more about controlling that identity. And the characteristics of sherry, which really come from the history of sherry, which I'll get into in a minute, but that blend of young and old has been the established what you expect from a bottle of sherry.
Hmm.
So it's a way of sort of ensuring that that palate is consistent forever.
Okay.
It's actually, the word Solera means floor, mm-hmm. Or ground, and that's because it used to be you just stack your barrels up and you could only take your sherry from the oldest barrel, which would be on the bottom. But what you do in between bottling is you top off your oldest barrel with your next oldest barrel and your next oldest barrel with your youngest barrel. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you're always pulling from your oldest barrel, but that oldest barrel is constantly accumulating younger sherries from generation to generation.
Right. Yeah, so it's a different reason that they blend for sherry than you do like in the wine business or the bourbon business. Usually the blends are to create the different values or to move stuff through to the market quicker.
Yeah, no, it's definitely this. In this case, it's definitely like this is the way we want it to taste, and we're going to ensure that year after year. Now, within that aging system, there's also two sort of other systems of aging that impact the flavor. And the first is biological. What that means is basically just that after the wine is fortified, it's only fortified to an amount that yeast can still survive in it. So at around 15.5, 16% alcohol, yeast can't live anymore. It's too alcoholic for the yeast to survive. So if you put your sherry in your barrel at under that percentage, a natural layer of yeast is going to grow on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, they don't fill the barrels all the way purposely to encourage this growth of yeast. And that yeast, it's called a floor, And it does two things. One, it protects the wine's delicate flavor from oxygen. And the other thing is it's going to eat up some of those remaining sugars in the wine and start converting a little bit more alcohol differently. It also flavors it. You get yeasty notes from sherry that's aged under a floor. I know that sounds confusing because floor is on top, but it's called floor. But it's more like flores and flower.
Oh, okay.
Blossoms, yes.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah. So if you have a sherry that just has that first kind of aging, it just has biological aging, and then, you know, after the floor starts to die out because you're getting too much fermentation, it's done, you pull it from the barrel, you bottle it, and those are your most driest, most delicate sherries. Those are the styles of Fino or Manzanilla are produced from just this one style of biological aging. They're very similar. The big difference is just that Manzanilla has to be made in Barrameda, whereas Fino can be made in any of the three cities. Now, the second style of aging is oxidative. Oxidative aging happens simply when a wine cannot grow a floor. So it goes into the barrel with a higher alcohol content than can sustain a floor of yeast. And thus, it's exposed to oxygen right away. This presents itself like the flavor notes of oxidized sherry. That's where you get the nuttiness, the sort of umami, the savory notes of sherry. Some sherry, they start with the oxidative aging. Like, that's where we get Oloroso sherry. Oloroso sherry is made where you take your sherry, you drive up the alcohol content higher than can support a floor, and then you age it like that, no floor. But you can also combine these two styles. You could start off with a biological aging, let it have a floor, let it be influenced by a floor, let the floor die off or purposely kill off the floor by adding alcohol to it, and then let it age more with oxidative aging, and that gets a secondary flavor profile going on. And that's where we find Amontillado.
Aha.
So there's also Pelo Cortado is another style that uses both biological and oxidative aging. But specifically, I mean, this, I think, is kind of informs why you would need a delicate palate to taste Amontillado, because it's going to have notes from both styles of aging. It has a lot going on. It's very complex. It's very condensed. It's not super sweet. It's not super dry. It's a really fascinating expression. And some people consider it the ultimate expression of sherry. Now, those other two that I mentioned, the sweeter ones, the Pedro Ximenez and the Muscadel, those also only undergo the oxidative aging, the secondary kind. And then those, they stop the fermentation before the sugars are fully converted because they just want more sugar in those. Those are the sweet dessert style sherries. Now, the last category of sherry, which is the one that if you've come in contact out in like the general marketplace with sherry, this is the one that gets the most play. And that's like sweetened sherries or cream sherries. And that's where you actually take a dry sherry, one of those Fino or Manzanillas, and then you blend it with one of the sweeter styles, or more commonly, you just add concentrated sweeteners to it to make a cheaper product.
I was going to ask you, now, the yeast that forms on the floor there, do they ever like scoop that off and use it in further sherry production? Like, you know, in beer, they use the same yeast. Yeast is a living organism, and they'll save that and start another batch of beer with the same yeast.
I mean, this is we're talking about like natural fermentation here. So this is ambient yeast that's growing, and that's just something that's always going to be in the atmosphere.
Oh, okay. So, like the way when they first made beer, that's what they did. They didn't understand fully the process, fermentation process. All they knew is if they left it sitting out with all this stuff floating in there, something good happened. That was about the extent of what they knew. It wasn't until they were able to fully scientifically examine what was going on that they understood the production of yeast and then knew to deliberately put it in there.
Well, that's definitely like in this case, they are purposely allowing the initial wine to ferment. And then the secondary fermentation that happens with the presence of the floor, the goal of that is to be natural fermentation. So that's always going to be something. They're not going to add it. They're going to let it develop naturally. And that little, it's a two fists worth of space that they leave in the barrel to accommodate the floor or the oxygen, either way.
Well, that could vary depending on the guy's fist who it is. Some big old guy with big meaty ham hock fists, that's more room than, you know, somebody who's more delicate.
this stuff is actually all like weighed and, you know, delicately proportioned. So I don't think they actually measure it with a fist. I think that's just kind of an idea. Like, you know, like a 2-finger pour of alcohol or a 3-finger pour. That's not actually a finger. That's just kind of a way of talking about like what about 2 ounces looks like in a glass.
Oh, okay. How about they just actually measured it that way?
Yeah, we just stick our fingers in your booze.
Yeah, give me two of those.
2 fingers worth of booze. So that's what sherry is. Now, I don't want to go, the history of sherry is long, and it butts right up against the history of Spanish wine as a whole, which is a really fascinating topic, but deserves its own episode. So I'm going to give you a little outline of how historically sherry came to be sherry, but it's going to be brief. So we've got...
Well, all right.
Got a
I'm all ears.
Centuries to go through here.
It's going
to
be brief. We got a couple of centuries.
We got a couple of centuries of information that I'm going to briefly explain to you in relation to sherry.
All right.
This is the history of the world, but only as it concerns sherry.
All right. Okay.
The only history I'm interested in. So the winemaking history in this region of Spain dates back to the city of Cadiz, which was founded around 9th century BC. So here's our starting point. 9th century BC. Sherry's been around for a while. All right, so what this city was a popular trading post. So you had the Phoenicians who brought winemaking knowledge from the ancient Middle East. And then after that, you had the Greeks show up and kind of go through town. And they dropped off their tradition of making concentrated sweet wine syrups that could be added to wine for sweetness. Mm-hmm. So after those two things occurred, you have the Romans show up, conquer the area. By then, this area had already developed its own unique style of blending wine from sweet concentrated must. And this style caught on favor throughout the Roman Empire. They called it Ceretanum, or wine from Ceret, which was the specific area that this sweet wine was known to come from. Then you had the Moors come in. They had a brief stint controlling the area, ironically bringing with them distilling knowledge, but also outlawing alcohol. So we didn't quite put the pieces together yet for everything we needed for sherry, but we had all the information by then. The Moors also renamed the home of sherry from Ceret to Xerix, which would evolve again to Jerez, and then Jerez de la Frontera, as you had the Spanish Christian empire pop up opposite the Moors. So point is, we end up with sherry from Jerez, which is Spanish for sherry.
And they said the more the better, huh?
Well, apparently not, because they were here's how to make alcohol, but don't drink it. It's a tricky game they play.
They like to dabble in temptation.
Yeah, I mean, they really like masters of distilling, but didn't want you to do it for immoral purposes, I guess.
For drinking purposes.
Yeah. So that brings us up to around. So that takes place up through the 13th century. Now, the next important event in the life of sherry is sort of the Age of Exploration. Magellan actually took off from the port of Cadiz. He definitely had sherry on board. Not only did he have sherry on board, his actual budget for his inventory on board had more money spent on sherry than weaponry.
Wow.
So
he was expecting to encounter more parties than enemies, huh?
I guess so. Columbus also took off from the same port, definitely had sherry on board. So sherry gets spread around the world via this. Around this time, we have war and empiric expansion taking place all throughout Europe. This shook the wine regions of France. It made it impossible to distribute from Italy. This was all during the 15th century. So Spain saw this as a great chance to dominate the marketplace, the sherry. It abolished export taxes. It gave preferential treatment to English merchants. Before long, English enjoyment of sherry, or as they would call it, sack, I don't know, flourished. Yeah. A lot of Shakespeare talks about sherry a lot, but he'll often call it sack, and that was an English term for it at the time. But its popularity expanded worldwide. Even as the English and Spanish relationship soured through the 16th century, you know, armadas and inquisitions and all that stuff, the English still had a thirst for sherry. In fact, catching wind of the building of the Spanish armada, English sea captain Sir Francis Drake was sent to the port of Cadiz on royal order to destroy the construction. And in process, he sacked the sack.
He sacked the sack, huh? He shut down the sherry making?
He stole about 3,000 barrels of sherry.
That's a lot of sherry.
It's a That's a lot of sherry. You sold a lot of sherry.
Yeah, you'd have to steal a boat, too, just to put them all on, I would think.
Well, I think he came on a boat. I think he loaded up his boats from their boats. Maybe he stole some of their boats.
It was a and whole flew back.
And sherry exchange.
Loaded up his boat with sherry and flew back.
Yeah, I don't think he flew. I don't think there was flying at this time. So in the 17th century, we have the Napoleonic Wars and the War of Spanish Succession. And while this does a lot of things in world history that matter to other people, what matters to sherry is that it interrupted the fluid sale of the stuff. So up till now, they could barely make it to keep up with how much demand they had. But with all this going on, they couldn't get it distributed anymore. So sherry sat around in barrels. And lo and behold, when they went to taste those barrels that sat way too long, it tasted awesome. To preserve this awesome taste. Yeah, so here was the discovery. Oh, wait, this is better.
So they were selling a short time sherry before. What they were doing, it didn't have the chance to develop fully like they do now.
Exactly. Yeah.
They discovered it by accident.
Mm-hmm. They were fermenting the stuff and just sweetening it, and then that was it. It was good to go. But after this happened, they started to find ways to try to actually keep this old sherry in the palate, and that's where you get the origins of the Solera system. They started saying, we're going to have the young sherry, but we want to sell it all now. So let's mix some of the old sherry with the young sherry, and then we have this awesome flavor in the young sherry. The other thing they did to try to preserve that taste is they realized that those barrels that had sat there had been exposed to, they'd both grown a floor and they'd also been exposed to oxidation. So that's when they start messing around with adding brandy, because we've had fermentation now we've had distillation for a while now, mm-hmm. for a while. But they start messing around with adding brandy at different stages to stop and start the floor development and add in oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
So that sitting around and messing around with it led to the eventual characteristics of sherry as we know them today.
Oh, now I've had brandy before. I just haven't had sherry.
Yeah, brandy is a grape based distillate, whereas sherry is a wine that's been infused with a grape based distillate. If that makes sense, so they're not very similar in palate at all. So that's where we get the flavor from sherry. Comes from history. Comes from a combination of accident and stress and experimentation.
Most of our drinks seem to have come from accident at some time or another.
No, that's very true. A lot of our, even like the initial decision to try alcohol really is fascinating when you think of kind of the rough origins of the stuff. Like, you got something rotting and fermenting and bubbling, and you're like, I should drink it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things, I guess, that fall into that. I think about the first guy that ever looked at a crab or a lobster and said, I bet that some bitch be good to eat. Nobody ever looked at one of those and said that. Who would look at one of those and say, let's eat that thing?
I don't know.
But somebody had to.
Spider.
Yeah, somebody had to have looked at it and said that. So it's the same type thing with some of these drinks. It's like somebody walked by and said, whoa, that went bad. Huh. I think I'll try a drink of that.
My favorite is there's a passage, I think it's in A Bottle of Rum is the book that it's in, that's talking about the history of rum along with the New World. And they talk about how when they didn't quite understand how rum worked, they just knew that the molasses runoff from sugarcane production, they would leave out in barrels because they could sell it for a cheap sugar source. But it would sometimes, stuff would fall in it and start to rot, and then it would ferment, and then it would make rum. And so they didn't know what was going on. So they just would shove stuff in it to try to make that happen. They just put, decaying plant matter, dead animals.
Old socks.
Whatever they could. Yeah, gross stuff. Like, early rum was really rough stuff because we didn't understand exactly what was going on. So we just put whatever was rotting and available, we would just stuff into the barrels and see what happened. it's a decaying horse in your rum.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, like all the old rum cocktails that are all like a ton of sugar and a ton of citrus, we get it now. Like, it was a different product. But yeah, so a little bit of a softer history with sherry. Sherry was probably delicious all the way back, but it just got better with time.
I see. All right.
But Yeah. Now, of course, like throughout the modern era, sherry kind of went in and out of flavor in various markets. It stayed popular in the UK and is to this day. They prefer the cream styles more, the sweeter sherries, whereas now in Spanish culture, the drier ones are more popular. And of course, with the modern cocktail revival of the last decade, that has brought a rekindled love for sherry in high-end bar programs across America and I'd say around the world. You know, now you see on any cocktail menu worth its salt, you'll probably see not only a small sherry menu, but probably a sherry cocktail or two.
I'll have to look for that.
Yeah. Oh, if you want to drink sherry, of course, you know, there are a couple like sort of notes as far as consuming it goes. It's shelf stable in the bottle, just like wine, but once you open it, it will go bad. The drier sherries for sure, and the medium ones. And it also doesn't benefit from aging. So buying that bottle of sherry at the store, keeping it in your cabinet for 5 years, won't make it better sherry. You know, some kind of develop slightly, but by and large, they won't.
So plan on just putting it in a paper sack and guzzling it down when you get it home, huh?
Well, you know, in Spain, especially like Fino sherry, which is like one of the youngest, most delicate sherries, they sell it in little half bottles. And if you don't finish it the day it's open, you're supposed to dump it out. I wouldn't do that, but yes, you know, you drink it and that's it. You drink it that day.
Well, that would be expensive at a bar to maintain it that way, unless they've got something better to keep it in than bottles, because otherwise, who's to say that, you know, you might serve one sherry and then nobody else shows up and you've got this whole bottle sitting there.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, it's similar with like wine. The way we price wine in restaurants is because wine really does, you can keep that bottle of Pinot in your fridge for a night and it might taste okay the next day, but that's about it. After about a day, 24 hours to like 36 hours of being open, wine is bad. It's lost its punch. And sherry is similar. So you kind of have to price it as the cost of the whole bottle. Like that's how most wine is priced in a restaurant. If you're drinking a $10 glass of wine, it's probably being poured from a $10 bottle of wine.
Oh, okay.
You price it that way to cover the cost, so that if you don't pour it again, you've at least broken even on your bottle.
Mm.
A little behind the scenes bit there.
Yeah. I would not have thought that.
Same way. Yeah. That's why sherry can be really expensive on menus, because you're right. Not a lot of people drink it. And in cocktails, too. I mean, as I've been taught to work with it, I'll usually mix it with I'll have it batched in with a higher proof alcohol or a really concentrated sweet syrup to preserve it longer, because those two things will preserve its shelf life. Mm. Which is why, like, the sweeter sherries, sweet and cream sherries, they have so much sugar in them that they'll be fine for weeks, if not months, after you open them. Yeah, the traditional glass for sherry is called a copita.
Copita?
Copita? Just kind of means little cup. It's the diminutive of cup.
And is it shaped like a small cup or a goblet or
it's like a little tulip. It's a little tulip
glass. Oh, a little tulip glass.
Yeah, they're really cute. They're really precious. However,
just put your tulips on it.
Yes. If you happen to be at like a sherry bodega and, you know, you might come across sherry served in maybe the coolest way it's served, and that's from a Venencia, which is like a, it's a narrow silver cup on like a big long handle that's meant to be dipped into the sherry cask so you can pull some sherry out and taste it as it's aging. But they've developed this really cool way of pouring it. Like you hold it at your head level and pour it into your copita from like a meter's distance. And it's a very like graceful, practiced way of pouring sherry straight from the barrel. People that can do this are called Venenciadores, which is cool.
Mm. Kind of like a matador.
Yeah, yeah, but just so much safer than fighting. Yeah. You're just pouring sherry. Yeah, they're actually competitions for it. I met, of all places, I met a bartender in Japan who had won a prestigious Venenciador award. Had gone to Spain and competed to be the best at pouring sherry.
Well, I bet there's some people that compete at being the best at drinking sherry.
I would enter that competition. I'm sure. If that was out there, sure. But the Venencias. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just make sure you're not a friend with Edgar Allan Poe.
and enter that competition, as it might be in his basement.
Yeah. Don't go with Edgar Allan Poe to any basement ever, no matter what kind of sherry he promises is there. That's what we've learned.
That's right.
But the Venezia is an old tool. There's actually like pictures of it on Greek pottery that show like people serving Achilles from a Venezia. So it's been around. Hmm. Like, I guess it doesn't predate sherry, but we've been using it for a while. So I think that's kind of cool.
So it's like me. I've been called that.
You predate sherry?
No, an old tool.
Oh. Well. Dad, I don't think you're too old. You are old. You're very old.
Very old. I'm aging just like fine wine. You just have to be blended or something.
You got a layer of flora on you. That's
that's not flora.
It's flora. It's helping me develop my flavor.
Yeah, that's what I'd like you to think.
So, you know, like a lot of wine, drier sherries are consumed slightly chilled, the medium and sweeter sherries, usually above room temperature. And, while tradition dictates, you usually drink it straight. There are some through history, like some popular mixes with it. Like the sherry cobbler is something that sounds like a pie, but it's not.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bunch of sherry with fruit in it, which sounds delicious. There's also the rebujito, which is sherry served long with like lemonade or a soft drink in it. And that's a more modern variant on how to serve sherry. So, yeah.
But if you're going to put it in that, probably you don't need to buy the real expensive stuff.
Yeah. And, you know, sherry is one of those products that like it can be very, very expensive. It can be very, very cheap. I would recommend something in the mid range. Like you can get a good bottle of sherry for 20-30 bucks. Just like a wine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That $7 handle of Bristol cream sherry is not going to be the best expression of sherry you're going to find. I've used that in a pinch sometimes for recipes, but you know, maybe.
But if you're
going to
if you're going to mix it with Mountain Dew, it doesn't really matter anyway.
I don't think I'm, you know what, sherry and Mountain Dew, if you want to do that, get the cheaper stuff. Although, to be fair, there's some pretty cheap, like not so bad, like Olorosos and Finos out there. There's some brand that my liquor store serves. I think it's like a $8 bottle. It's not the worst. One, I could justify putting that in Mountain Dew, see what it's like.
that's their advertising slogan. It's not the worst.
It's not the worst. I feel that. But yeah, I've had plenty of sherries in the very affordable price range that are delicious and really cool. I think that they're, honestly, I'd say you might like it, Dad, because to me, it's less so for like a wine drinker, because they're a lot heavier and they're a lot more complex. And I think it's more if you're a fan of bourbon or brandy. I think it's a little bit lighter, but it's definitely in more that wheelhouse, I think, because it's a great sipping spirit.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, that'll be good. I used to like to sip on brandy now and then, heat it up in the glass and sip on it.
What kind of brandy was that, though?
Apricot.
Was it the Mr. Boston's?
Probably.
Yeah.
We used to do that in college. We thought we were sophisticated.
I mean, honestly, for college, that's pretty good. Like,
I'm sure we bought the cheapest stuff available.
It's not vanilla Coke with vanilla vodka, which was my college drink of choice.
Oh.
That was terrible.
Hmm. Yeah.
I still to this day have a problem with vanilla because of that combo.
I like vanilla. I always get that scent for my car.
Your car smells like my regret, so there's that. So back to Poe, circling back to our man.
Circling back. Yeah, I mean, it is Halloween. It is our Halloween theme, and that's who started this whole talk of sherry.
Yes, he introduced many of us to probably a curiosity about sherry. Now, is Amontillado or sherry in general worth a live burial? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe not.
I'm not going to think it is. I will say no.
It's good. I haven't tried the really expensive stuff, but I would still say it's maybe not that good. But it is kind of sad that, you know, in the case of Poe's death, he did sort of, possibly alcohol did factor into his demise.
Well, and they tried to say here. they tried to say that alcohol had a lot to do with his writing, that it was alcohol-induced writings, because a lot of, you know, of course, his writings were dark and stuff like that. But actually, he led a life of tragedy from an early age. His mother died when he was young. His father didn't really want him. They sent him away. He stayed with an aunt, and she had a daughter that was his cousin that, well, they ended up getting married. So his aunt became his mother-in-law. But then his mother-in-law died, but she was very good to him and really liked him and looked out for him, and she died. And then his cousin/wife died. And so he led a very tragic life that probably brought about a lot of the darkness that was in his writings.
And he really didn't get, I mean, as much as clearly his writing was known enough to have these rivals and enemies, he didn't get compensated. He struggled.
Right. Yeah. And so he's credited with creating the whole genre of detective fiction with his 1841 story, The Murders in the Rue Morgue. And that paved the way for later fictional sleuths, all the way from Sherlock Holmes to Nancy Drew. But, you know, there's a lot of stories that you've probably heard of. The Telltale Heart, the Raven, Nevermore, Nevermore. You know, that's where, of course, he spent a lot of his time living in Baltimore, and that's why the Baltimore Ravens are named the Baltimore Ravens. They're named after Edgar Allan Poe's writing. And, of course, there's a whole story behind that, why they're the Ravens. They used to be the Baltimore Colts. They slipped out of town in the middle of the night and went to Indianapolis and took the name with them. So when Baltimore got a team later, they named themselves the Ravens. But that team was actually the Cleveland Browns, but the Browns wouldn't let them have the name Browns.
I don't understand how a sports team can just abscond with itself overnight.
No, they did it. I was living in Baltimore at the time, and the headline the next day said, Colts left in middle of the night. And they literally did.
That's very silly.
Yeah.
I think ultimately it was a good thing, at least for the aesthetics, because I'm not a sports fan, but that some of that Baltimore Ravens merch is pretty good. They got a good color palette going on. They got a good bird. I'm a fan.
Yeah. There you go. Because of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
But then there's a lot of mystery surrounding his death as well.
Yeah, because his death was, so he was found just wandering the streets on October 3rd of 1849. He was just delirious in the streets of Baltimore, and they took him to a hospital, but he never recovered. He died a few days later on October 7th. But yeah, there was a lot of weird stuff. He hadn't been accounted for several days. He was wearing clothes that weren't his. They were tattered old clothes. And he didn't give any, what was it? He kept saying the name Randall, I think. But there was no clues to what had happened to him.
No, and there's lots of things that they have, you know, pondered. You know, part of it was the drinking. They said that they actually put on his death certificate first congestion of the brain, which, what is that?
Well, apparently that is a euphemism of the time for people that died of drinking or drug overdoses. That was kind of the kinder way to reference more or less savory ways of dying, I guess.
Yeah, but they never really found what caused it. And as recently as 1999, they got some of his hair. They exhumed part of his body and ran some tests because there was a theory that it could have been carbon monoxide poisoning from a coal-fired stove. And there's others that thought he may have had lead poisoning, that it was consistent with that. And there was others that said that a lot of his symptoms were consistent with rabies, although they never mentioned him having any bites or having gotten bitten or what would have bitten him. You're in Baltimore. What would bite you in Baltimore?
I don't know. They got raccoons there, right? Although they get unfairly pegged with rabies as rabies carriers a lot. Well, you know, one thing that's topical, one of the possible ways that he could have, what could have happened to him, rather, which it's topical, weirdly, because it's about election fraud. But this is actual election fraud, not this fabricated stuff that we see in the news. And that's that that there was a practice at the time called cooping.
Mm-hmm.
Which was basically like a person would be tempted with like a bunch of alcohol. They'd get somebody drunk, and then they would take them to the polls to vote. And then after they came out of the polls, they put them in different clothes and send them back in to vote again. And they'd do this several, as long as they could get away with it, basically. And mm-hmm. you abandon the person when they're done with them. So,
and strangely enough, the voting places in those days were bars. That's where you went to vote, was bars anyway.
That's a terrible idea.
I know. And so they when they found him, and he's dressed in these strange hand-me-down clothes, and he was always known for his black suit that he wore everywhere, and he's in these strange hand-me-down clothes, like the way they described it was like a white suit or a cream-colored suit with a straw hat. It was like, you know, like a country bumpkin that rolled in off the farm, you know, and yee-haw, looky here, it's a big town. And that was not who he was.
Not to make light of his end, because it's very tragic, but the thought of being having a dedicated goth aesthetic only to be found in a cream suit in your demise, that is
a... And a straw hat.
That is an insult that I think is no one should endure.
So, you know, they said that he either was beaten or he was, you know, drinking as a result of the cooping. They looked at carbon monoxide, heavy metal, rabies. Brain tumor was another one. Because he was in the ground for almost 30 years at an unmarked marker, because he basically died penniless. And they put him at this unnamed marker, and they eventually, 35 years later, raised money to move him to a more prominent part of the cemetery and give him a headstone. And at the time, they said that his skull was intact, but inside was like a little golf ball size piece of something. And doctors have theorized that that could have been a tumor that calcified. And it would still be there. His brain wouldn't be that after all that time, but a tumor could calcify and still be in there. But they say it was like rattling around inside the skull.
Well, that sounds like a terrifying way of exhuming a body.
Yeah, true. They also said it could have been as simple as the flu. He may have caught the flu at the time.
Huh.
And then there's other rumors that a lady that was going to donate money to him for a literary club that he was trying to get open, that she had sons that or brothers that did not want him dealing with her, and that they may have murdered him.
So it seems like anything is possible in this situation.
Yeah. But there's others that feel that a lot of the symptoms he displayed actually would have been currently diagnosed as either encephalitis or meningitis, which they were not equipped to diagnose that at the time.
It's a sad end to what seems like an important life, and, you know, on the scale of things, a successful life, but maybe not the life he lived, just the legacy he left behind.
Yeah, and then you had the whole tradition of the Poe toaster.
Oh, is that the shady character that they bring a rose to his grave and a bottle?
Cognac.
Ah.
It started happening in the 1930s. Is that someone would show up and they would play a violin with the music Dance Macabre, and when they finished, they would give him a toast. I don't know how to say this. I guess it's in French, I guess. But it says, fame comes too late to the dead, is what the saying was. And then he also left notes by the grave. And through the years, the notes gave different indications as to what the things meant. This toaster would drink cognac and then leave the rest of the bottle there for him. And so this... people became aware of this, and they started turning out, and the spectacle was more everybody showing up at midnight to see the toaster, and eventually the guy went away. Now, it's been rumored that this was a family tradition, that a family passed down from one person to another, because it went on for a long time, stopped back in about 2006, and there was a 92-year-old guy that claimed to be the one that did it. But the Edgar Allan Poe Society people said, no, it wasn't him. They didn't like that. But then they kind of decided in 2009, which was the bicentennial of Poe's birth, that they would have their own person. So they now have a person from this Edgar Allan Poe Society that does this. But instead of doing it at midnight and everybody coming out there and it being a big mess, they do it in the middle of the day now so everybody can get a good photograph and everything. So there's not the mystery that surrounds it like did for a long time.
That is cool. I'm sad that I never could have seen the actual mysterious toaster. You know,
And he also left three white roses. And the roses, the three white roses of significance was one was for his mother, one was for his cousin slash wife, and the other was for his aunt slash mother-in-law.
Well, that's sweet.
Yeah.
I think it's sweet.
Yeah. You know, it's all in the family.
Well, you know, it's different times, but... you know, if you're looking for something safe and that you can do inside during your quarantined Halloween, you can maybe, you know, read some of Poe's stories. There are a lot of also some good movie adaptions of a couple of these. I noticed that Shudder just added The Mask of the Red Death to their streaming service.
Pit in the Pendulum. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
That's a good one. He wrote a lot of crazy, scary things, and he was way ahead of his time as far as those kind of things went. And I think that writing about those things also lent people say something must be wrong with him. Well, he probably drinks a lot.
It's funny because even in the even with a lot of the people that were like recognized drinkers, they like specifically went out of their way to say no, I don't drink when I write. You can't do that. And likewise, it's like it's hard to read Poe's like incredibly detailed, very like he thinks out his narratives very precisely. I can't. How could you write that when you were?
No,
wasted?
I wouldn't think so. No.
Hunter S. Thompson, I'm like, yeah, he was super high, but Edgar Allan Poe, I'm like, no way, this guy was sober. Yeah, for this Halloween, you could maybe take it as an opportunity to try out some sherry. Maybe get your own bottle of Amontillado safely from a store, not following a masked man into a basement. And,
nope, don't do that.
Yeah, check out some Edgar Allan Poe. That sounds like a good, safe, spooky quarantine ween.
That's right. And for me, I watch the Baltimore Ravens play and think about Edgar Allan Poe.
That works,
how about
too.
That?
Figure out how to get you some sherry. I think you'd like it if you tried it. I think if you tried good sherry, you'd like it.
I will try that. You're going to be in town soon, so we'll try that.
Yeah, I'll get you some sherry. I'll have to sneak some in, I guess.
Well, we can get. I'm sure we can find some around here. Some West Virginia sherry.
West Virginia sherry. That's the other appellation for sherry. It can be made in these very specific towns in Spain or West Virginia.
Guyandot. If you say it fancy enough, it'll work.
Is that that fancy guy in that? Right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look forward to that.
All right.
Well, I have been Taylor Smurl.
And I have been Tommy Smurl.
And this has been
Neat.